Today we're looking at Saul and a failed leader. And it's a sad lesson. It really is. It's a sad lesson because of not only what Saul is and how that he had such great opportunities, but it's a sad lesson because sometimes I think we can see ourselves in Saul and some of his failings. And I guess that's a good thing if we can see ourselves and then do the things that would correct it. See, the difference with Saul is that Saul is a failed leader, not because he made mistakes, but because he didn't recognize his mistakes. And whenever he had the opportunity to correct them, he continued to follow through with them, the mistakes. And in the end, he lost it all. And so in our lives, you know, the Bible says, he who knows to do right and doesn't do it, to him it is sin. And so whenever we look at our lives, and it's like one interview said, there's two types of sin. They're both sin, but there's two types. One is the just kind of being swept away in the moment. You know, we get caught up in something, and the next thing you know is, my gosh, I can't believe I said that, can't believe I did that, can't believe I went there, can't, you know, all this stuff, and we just feel like I really, really blew it. Now, that type of sin, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to say, well, it doesn't matter? Are we going to repent and we're going to change? That's one type of sin. Second type of sin is premeditated. It is a definite planning to carry something out that we know is wrong and deliberately doing it and seeing it through to the end because I made up my mind, I'm going to do it, I'm doing it, and I've planned it, and, you know, like vengeance or hurting, or if I get the chance, I'm going to really do this and that, and we plan for that moment. Okay, that's the other type of sin. And actually, that is a worse type of sin, the premeditated. Because, and the idea of it being worse is that it isn't so much that one sin is, you know, I think some religions call it menial sins, you know, little sins and not, you know, little white sins and black sins and, you know, all that kind of stuff. No, I think meaning worse is that the attitude of the person committing it. Whenever our attitude is a premeditated planning, it depicts an attitude that is seared and saying, I don't care what God says, I'm going to do it my way. Well, that is a definite declaration that our heart is in a worse off condition than a person who is caught up in a situation and sees it through and then says, oh my gosh, I shouldn't have done that. All right. So we'll read the scripture. Now we'll just read it as we go through. But the key verse is, what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justice, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God? So what is it that God really expects of us? He expects of us to do justly. What is just? Just in the eyes of God. Not justifying our actions because we think they're right or we want to prove them right. We see that in Saul. But to love mercy. Not only for our own lives, but for the lives of others. To walk humbly with God. That God is the one who is to receive the credit, the blessing, the honor for what is done in our lives. Okay, so we'll read the lesson as we go through it. Okay. Now, no one is exempt from failure. Okay? The only person who is exempt from failure is the person who doesn't do anything, and then that's a failure. So, failure, and so many times, you know, I liken it whenever the kids on computers, okay? Kids on computers, they treat it like, what? What do kids do on computers? What does Megan do on computers? Plays games. Does she think about pushing wrong buttons? No, she just pushes buttons. Why? What's that? Yeah, she don't have to worry about fixing it. And she don't think she can do anything wrong. Because why? Because all you're doing is pushing the buttons and all that stuff's going on. So what if something goes wrong? Fix it. What do we do? Well, what if I push the wrong button and it all goes away? What if I erase this? And what if I make a mistake? What if I ruined it and break the whole thing? So we are afraid of failing. And whenever we are afraid of failure, what do? We restrict our activity. We put boundaries upon what we can and cannot do. Why? Because we're afraid that we're going to fail. So failure is not, God is not worried about our failures. God's not worried at all anyhow, but he's not worried about our failures. Because, you know, how do we know it's a failure? What's the greatest teacher? What's the greatest teacher? Experience. Experience is the greatest teacher. So, we are afraid of failure. We are afraid of the teacher. So, if we are afraid of the experience and we're afraid of failure, what do? Nothing. And what have we done? We failed. So if we are afraid of God, you know, if we are afraid of sin, if we are afraid, no, we're going to know what's right and what's wrong. Why? Because God's going to lead us, guide us in all this. So personal failure may be caused by many different things. One, laziness. if I do this, I might not make it, so maybe I don't want to do anything. I think maybe we all know someone like that. Do you all know people like that? I was going to use one for an illustration, but no need. Circumstances that are beyond our control. Well, I may try it, but what if this happens? You know, I liked what the one guy said. If you're sitting in your driveway waiting for all the lights to turn green before you pull out of the driveway, you're not going to do anything. There was one guy I counseled years ago. He was afraid of stop signs and red lights. He did not want to travel anywhere where there was a stop sign or a red light. He not get rear-ended, but he's everywhere. He would go everywhere, and I don't know how he did it, but he wouldn't, you know, he didn't want to stop. He didn't want to stop at lights. At there, you know, red lights were like set him off in a panic attack. And so he was deathly afraid of red lights, and he always wanted to turn right so he didn't have to wait his stop signs. He had a problem. It's like one of Rhonda's kids in the class. There was one of the kids was being hyper and jumping around and saying everything, and the little boy looks up at Rhonda and says, "You know, they make medication for that." So this individual needed some medication. So, unexpected economic downturns, you know, there are things that we can't predict. Sometimes impetuousness creates settings of unnecessary high percentages of potential failure, meaning sometimes we just get in a hurry. We want things done, so we start out, we don't think things through. Good ideas are pursued without sufficient preparation. Rushing ahead without considering all the timely results necessary. You know, there are many ways that we can set ourselves up to fail, but we can become so over-analytical that we never do anything either. So we've got to arrive at a balance. Some leaders become enamored with their positions. I'm not going to talk about that one. People that they love their positions and, you know, God has to look up to them because they're so good at what they do. And we've perhaps served under people like that. Hopefully we, you know, but the idea is that sometimes there's got to be a balance between having the authority of the position because your head's on the line if it doesn't work, and having the authority of the position to make everybody else uncomfortable. Okay? So, in Saul, we can see ourselves maybe in all of these things. Sometimes we've done the right things for the wrong reasons, and sometimes we've done wrong things and thought we were right. Saul appears to be the whole package, you know? Saul's the total package. When he's anointed king, he is humble. He's hiding in the luggage, in the baggage. He doesn't want to be out in front of people, but he's a head taller than everyone else. He appears to be mature, well-adjusted. He prophesies with the prophets. He's godly. And everything seems to be in place for Saul, the first king of Israel. Well, he becomes a man of rebellion rather than obedience. Things change. Things change in Saul's life. Now, the question is, was he always bad? Was his humility a show? Or did he allow what had taken place in his life to change him? Pardon? Well, in the lesson that we find today, he becomes very impatient. He's in a very critical place, and he becomes very impatient. And now this is like two years into his kingship, into his position that he has as ruler of Israel, and he is faced with a crisis, and we'll read the crisis here in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. Someone want to read that? 1 Samuel chapter 13, and we'll read verses 1 through 7. So Saul goes to war, okay? Jonathan has 1,000 men, and Saul has 2,000 men. And Jonathan attacks an outpost of the Philistines, and he conquers it was a big victory for him at this time. And so they join their forces together. But the Philistines hear about this attack, and they see it as a full-fledged war. So the Philistines come back and they are ready for war, and they have 3,000 chariots. Now, if you can, you know, the analogy is a chariot and a tank, you know, a chariot against infantry. So it would be like a tank in modern day warfare fighting infantry. So there's 3,000 Israelites there for battle, and there are 3,000 chariots of the Philistines, plus all of their soldiers, you know, plus, you know, everything else that is amassed there for this battle. So the people of Israel, you know, the soldiers of Israel, you have 3,000 chariots and you have 3,000 people, men in your service. What happens to the 3,000 people who are with Saul and Jonathan? They take to hiding and they take off. They are, you know, this is not a battle I want to fight, so they leave, they flee, they cross over the Jordan, they get out of town, they hide, they desert. And so this small force of Israelites, they began to defect. Approximately 80% of the army leaves. So you have 3,000 people and 80% leaves. Well, let's see, 3,000 and 80%. That leaves you with 3,000, half is 15, 700, between 800, about 8, is that it? 80%, 800, 700, 600 men. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, 80% is 600. So you got 600 people left out of 3,000. And you got 600 surrounding Saul. And you've got 3,000 chariots plus the rest of the army. So what do you think you're going to do? How about 8 and 9? Oh, the chapter 8, and yeah, verses 8 and 9, and he tarried 7 days. Okay, so here they are. What did I say, 600? 600 men. And Saul, you know, appeals, he hears from the prophet, Samuel. Now, Samuel tells Saul, you go to Gilgal and you wait. I'll be there in 7 days. And I'll tell you what God is going to do. So, all right, have you ever waited for something and waited and the pressure's on? And the pressure's on. And the pressure's on. Okay, you've got 600 men, 3,000 chariots, and this whole army just waiting out there. You don't know when they're going to attack. You don't know what they're going to do. And the prophet of God says, go and wait for 7 days, and I'll be there and tell you what's up. So, so, and Saul said, verse 9, what's he say? Verse 9, bring me burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. And Saul offered up the burnt offerings. Is Saul a priest? No. Is Saul the prophet? No. But I've seen what they do. So I'm going to do it myself. I'm the king. I can do this. I can do this. It's not a big deal. You know, I know Samuel's a man of God, but, you know, I'm the king. So he offers up the sacrifices. In verse 10 through 14. Salute him. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you for a moment. So it came to pass, all right, Samuel shows up. Wouldn't you know it, as soon as I do what I'm, you know, as soon as you do the wrong thing, there you are faced with it. All right, so what are you going to do with the wrong thing that you're now faced with? Now, the 7 days hadn't completely ended. He still had some more time on the 7 days. But Saul's in a hurry. So Samuel doesn't show up in the time that Saul thought he should, but it still wasn't up. You know, that God always is on time? Sometimes not with our schedule, but with his. So Samuel shows up, and Saul goes out to meet him. And what's he going to do? He's going to salute him. I'm going to pay tribute to Saul. I'm going to pay tribute to Samuel. I'm going to, honor him as the prophet. In verse 11. Micmash. So, it's not my fault, Samuel. It's not my fault. You see, the people are scattered. I had 3,000. I'm sure I could have taken the armies on with 3,000, but now I'm down to 600. And my people scattered, and the Philistines, they're gathered over there at Michmash, and they're going to come after me, and I got to do something. It's been 7 days, and I gave you almost seven full days. You said 7 days, and I gave you almost that full amount of time. Verse 12, therefore, said I, the Philistines will come down and now upon me at Gilgal. Philistines are coming. Philistines are coming. I got to do something. They're not here yet, but I know they're coming. I have not made supplication. It's not my fault. I wanted to offer something to God. You weren't here. Can you hear Saul talking here? He said, you weren't here, Samuel. I wanted to do something for God. Saul was practicing being a politician. Now, not all political people are, but the worst of the political individuals. Yeah, delete that one. So we want to make sure we only, we don't want to offend anyone, but anyone who is trying to smooth over something and cover it over. And we find out later on, of course, God knows the thoughts and the intents of our heart. So the idea is to be open with ourselves and open with God and open with people. And if people don't understand, the most important thing is that God understands and you understand. Why? So we don't set ourselves up to be like Saul. Well, Saul is, he's placating and he's smoothing over his actions. I forced myself. I love this guy. I don't, but did you ever hear somebody just out and out lie and just tell it like it is so convincing and so truthful? They stole something and they have it in their hand and you say, you stole that. Oh, no, I didn't steal it. How'd you get it? Well, I was just walking by. And I picked it up, but I had to have it. And it really, no one was watching, and no one was around. And it really, I know that the person wanted me to have it. And did you steal it? No. Well, what's in your hand? Yeah. How'd you get it? I picked it up. Did you steal it? No. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? Well, the idea is that we need to be honest with ourselves and whatever. But Saul was not honest with himself, nor with Samuel, nor with God. And Samuel said to Saul, okay, first, I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. I forced myself to do it. And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the command of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever? This was like the focal point, fulcrum, the tipping point. There's a book called Tipping Points, good one. It's when things move one way or the other. And what establishes the tipping point? And it's whenever, in the book, it talks about, the book, The Tipping Point, talks about Hush Puppy Shoes. I remember this one. Hush puppy shoes. Anybody know what hush puppy shoes are? All right. So hush puppy shoes were about to go under. They were going to totally take it off the market. Well, what happened was there was some guy in New York. I think it's New York. Say it's New York. Was in the advertising. And he saw these shoes and he put them in an ad. The ad became very successful. And he wasn't selling shoes, he was selling something else. But the shoes were part of the ad. So it had nothing to do with the shoes, but the shoes were part of the ad. And people saw the ad, but they also noticed the shoes. And the sale of like these hush puppy shoes went from virtually nothing to off the chart. They couldn't keep them in the stores. That became the tipping point, was that ad. Now, what did the company do to create that? Nothing. The company's advertisement, nothing. It was the person who was compiling this ad saw another individual walking in these shoes on a street or in a store in New York City, saw them and said, "I want to put those in the ad that I'm billing or putting together for someone else." And so they were an afterthought of the person who was doing the advertisement, put them in an ad in which their shoes were not the primary purpose of the ad, but yet they had a complete and total effect upon the shoes. Tipping point. Here is the tipping point for Saul. He was supposed to wait for Samuel, and he had this message from Samuel. But he didn't do it. He didn't wait. And Samuel tells him, "The kingdom is gone from you forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart. The Lord hath commanded him to be a captain over his people, because you have not kept that which the Lord commanded you." So, perhaps I always wonder if this is why when David was anointed king, Saul wanted to kill him. Because he wanted to stop what God had started at this promise. I don't know, it's just one of my thoughts. That he really went after David and tries to kill him because he wants to ruin, as it were, what God had said that he would establish. And I think of this as people who come after Christians and they don't even know why they come after you. They want to tear you down, they want to destroy you, they want to destroy your reputation, they want to destroy whatever it is that you have because they feel something inside of them. It's not just an ego thing that, well, you know, we're better than in the world's against, not that kind of stuff. There are some people who just don't like you because they don't like you and they really can't tell you why. Those are the individuals that I'm talking about. That's why we can't do that, you and I as Christians, we cannot do that to other people. We can't, "I don't like him because I don't like him because I don't like him." Well, can't do that. Why? Because God loves them. So, we'll go on. Samuel also says to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over the people, over Israel. Now therefore, hearken thou unto the voice of the words of the Lord." This is 1 Samuel 15, verses 1 to 9. "I remember that which Amalek did to Israel." Now, going back in history, little history lesson. When the children of Israel came out of Egypt, Amalek, you know, when Israel was at their weakest point, the Amalekites, came up against Israel and fought them and tried to destroy them. You know, here's this infant slave nation just coming out of Egypt, and they came against Israel. And back then, God promised that he would come against them because of their wickedness. Well, verse 3 says, "Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, slay them." This was the time that God was going to fulfill his punishment against this group of individuals. Now, there's always this thing I look at is the thing called timing. You know, just like we said about the tipping point. When the children of Israel were to occupy the promised land, you know, when God gave the promise to Abraham, he said, "Their iniquity is not yet full. So therefore, you can't go get the land just yet. But I know what they're going to do in the future, and they're not going to repent of their ways. So there was this timing involved in which God was waiting, as it were, for the people to change. They had, just like Saul has the opportunity to do good and he fails. He chooses evil. Well, people can continue to choose evil and evil and evil until finally they reach the place where God says enough is enough. Because God doesn't stop evil people immediately doesn't mean that his grace and mercy is exhausted. And here the Amalekites, as it were, have exhausted the grace of God at this point in time, and God was going to use the children of Israel to bring judgment against them. Just as with Israel in later times when they were rebelling against God, God would allow other nations to come in and take control of them. So he was able to use circumstances to bring about a spiritual understanding. Same thing in our own lives. How often do circumstances bring about a spiritual understanding in our own lives? And this is a circumstance here. So, Samuel gives to Saul an order. You go and you kill every, and you have to wipe it out. And now, in our day, we look at this and say, wow, that was not good. Well, what happens is this is like a typology type thing where it's a type of sin. That you cannot allow sin to occupy your life. It has to be totally eradicated. You allow sin to be in your life, it is going to eventually destroy you. It's going to come up and you're going to have to pay for it. And the idea to don't do right and don't do it becomes sin. If there are things in our life that we're doing we know are wrong, we better start paying attention to them and get them out of our life, because they will affect us. What did Saul do with the city of Amalek? He waited in the valley. He got out the Kenites, because they were the son-in-law of whom? They were related to Israel in some way. And so he says, get out of town, because we're going to destroy the Amalekites. Then he took Agath, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Now, what was he supposed to do? He was supposed to destroy. But Saul, in those days, they would cut the thumbs and the big toes off of the kings to, as it were, as a sign of debilitating them. And that, so Saul was going to march the king back into town, and look how big I am. He was trying to disprove the prophet and saying, God's going to remove you from the throne. David and Saul is saying, I'm going to bring the king back. I'm going to show everybody what a big guy I am. They're not going to forget me, Samuel. They're not going to forget me. Look what I did. I brought the king back. I'm the conquering king. And I brought all the spoils back. So he didn't kill all he kept the king alive, and he kept all the best of the animals alive. Well, this was Saul's second chance. When he disobeyed God by offering the sacrifice and before Samuel got there, God gave him a judgment against him. But he gave him a second chance to obey. What'd Saul do? He blew it. He blew a second chance. He brought the king and everything back. And Samuel came to Saul, verse 13. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Saul, I mean, the guy is just like, hey, Samuel, I did everything you told me to do. And Samuel said, do I hear sheep? Do I hear sheep? Verse 14. And oxen. And Saul said, well, they have brought them from the Amalekites. The people. It's not my fault. It's the soldiers. They spared the best of the sheep and the oxen, but they did it for a good purpose. They want to sacrifice to God. We're going to take him back to the city, and we're going to have a big sacrifice. Show everybody how wonderful God is. Yeah. Well, he is now. Yeah, since Samuel came. Yeah, but no, we don't know what his intent was. But either way, he gets all the credit. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stay, and I will tell thee what the Lord has said to me this night." And Samuel said, "When thou wast little," he reviewed him, what he was like whenever he was young. He had the right attitude. He had the right heart. He was supposed to be the big king. He was supposed to be king of Israel. He was supposed to be a man of God and lead the people. But the people took the spoils, the sheep and the oxen, the chief things, verse 21. They should have utterly destroyed to sacrifice the Lord. And Samuel said, "Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" So he asked Saul a question. Does God really enjoy your burnt offerings, or does he delight in your actions in obeying the word? And this is the whole point of obeying what we know to be right. Doing what is right for the reason that it is right. And that's the sad thing that really is sad about Saul, is that he did this to gain the favor of men, but he lost the favor of God. And then verse 35, "And Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death." That's the saddest. I don't think there's anything sadder. And who created this? Saul did. By his deliberate disobedience.
It's just funny when you look back, he didn't even want to be a king.
Right.
He didn't want that. But with the people, they're supposed to cry out before the king. So God said, "Okay, I'll give you a king so you can rule for
right.
the other people, but I will still speak to the prophet that will give the king instruction."
Right. Yeah, when Saul decided, I am king.
Yeah, I am king.
Yeah.
God made me king, so I can be
the I'm in charge.
Like the other
yeah. Yeah. It's a sad story for Israel wanting a king in the first place and not wanting to obey God. But sometimes it's like that even with the church. We want spiritual leaders out there that we can look at and say, they, look what they're doing. Look how big their ministry is. Look how wonderful they are. And we have these people out there and they become see what God is doing. And sometimes these individuals fall because God is about each of us. It isn't there's something wrong with the big or the small. It's the idea that God has ordained certain things in each of our lives, and it's important that we fulfill them to the best of our ability, so that whatever is big or whatever is small, whatever is going on in our life, that it's the best for us, and we have the right attitude about it. We can't be against somebody who is big, and we can't be against somebody who is small, and can't be against somebody who's in the middle. Why? But we have to be for God, and for God being in each of these situations. And that's what I think is important about leadership and about who we are as individuals. God is in our lives. And it's important that we obey him and not just go through the sacrificial rituals that we think will make God happy. What makes God happy? You and I loving him.